Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
Imagine what it must have been like to go mad in the early days of the colony of New South Wales. Well, that's how they would have spoken about it. Who would decide if you were mad? Would you get any help? What would happen to the business you ran or the ship that you captained? Far from home, imprisoned or settled in an open-air colony on the other side of the world, plenty of the European inhabitants of the colony of New South Wales found themselves experiencing some form of mental illness, including, for example, the famous John MacArthur, who spent the final days of his life in what his own wife, Elizabeth, described as a partial derangement of the mind. That might have been saying it mildly as well. James Dunk's an historian. He's been exploring these questions in a new book called Bedlam and Botany Bay, and he's with us on Nightlife tonight to explore those ideas with us. James, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much.
We're using the term mad because that's how they spoke about it, wasn't it? You probably wouldn't use the term today. Well, you certainly wouldn't use the term today, but no. At the time, of course, it was. That's what it was called, mad. There was no discussion of mental health, was there?
No, none at all. No, they used all sorts of words. You know, raving mad, stark.
Stark raving mad.
That's right. That word's actually used. They talked about the noise.
But that was a degree of severity, was it? So someone who was stark raving mad was considerably more ill than somebody who wasn't.
Well, it depends. It's also just to make the effect. You know, stark raving mad is a pretty profound way of saying this person has a problem, has some suffering inside, and it's coming out, it's spilling out.
The history of mental illness, of course, is not a very pretty one because it's been one of those things that has been so little understood and therefore feared the most. And fear breeds all sorts of prejudice and so on, as we know, in the history of mental illness. But with all that in mind, you didn't get much of a fair go if you're mentally ill back in the old country. It must have been pretty much worse out here, wasn't it?
It's definitely worse in the sense that there weren't any of these institutions for,
not that those institutions were probably likely to do you much
good
anyway.
I mean, that's true in a sense. But at the same time, at the end of the 18th century, you have these new institutions in England, you know, the retreat, which is at York, or some of the London hospitals. They were really trying to do new things. They developed this thing called moral therapy, and they started to treat patients with respect and kindness and gentleness. And across these decades that we're talking about, the first few decades in the 19th century, they really made a lot of impact on English and European asylums, in France in particular, in Italy. But as you say, in New South Wales, not so much. You know, the first asylum doesn't appear for more than 20 years. And it's not much of an asylum. It's nothing like those built-up institutions.
What is it?
Well, it's a granary or a barracks or a barn. It's not quite clear, actually, but it's a big stone building, and they do some very minor renovations to it in 1811 and then move some patients, I guess is one word for saying, to people who are suffering from madness from Parramatta Jail there. It's not very clear who they are or what their lives were like, but we know that they weren't enjoying, you know, occupational therapy. They weren't enjoying psychotherapy. Mm. They were being fed and clothed.
Victorians being, well, the 19th century Victorians being what they were, they would have kept records. Are there well-kept records of who they were?
Actually, not so much. I mean, we do have quite impressive convict records, but the asylums, no. The first two asylums were at Castle Hill and Liverpool. Very little records survive from either of them. So we have a few names here and there. We have a few occupations, a few details which shed some light. And occasionally letters were written, you know, for problems that arose. But we don't have a very clear sense of, you know, the breakdown of what the patients were like or what their histories were before they came to the asylum.
Mm. It must have been a frightening idea, I must say, losing a grip on reality so far from home and help. Do you think the very fact of being here in New South Wales, was there a link between that in the public mind, maybe in the patient's mind as well, between that and their illness?
Sometimes there certainly was. And I mean, if we think about something like trauma that we might experience today or understand today, being sent halfway across the world to a place you don't know almost anything about, or you have these rumours, perhaps, which are terrible rumours about, great violence and flogging and executions and the local Aboriginal people who, were not exactly happy at this point about their lands being taken away from them. So there are rumors, but there's also a lot of things that just were not known about this place. And then when you get here, there's a lot of uncertainty about what life is going to be like. What are the limits of the state power? You know, you're in a place you don't know with people you don't know, being disciplined and worked, and trying to make a living, especially in these first few years. It's chaotic, actually.
Yeah. What would a diagnosis of mental illness be like back in post 1788? You mentioned some of the phrases at the beginning of this talk. Mm. How was it referred to?
Well, one of the things to kind of start with is that it's often not the doctors who are doing the diagnosis. A lot of the madness comes to our attention through the courts or through the convict authorities, through the governor and the magistrates, who are responding to problems essentially of order. Mm-hmm. And so they are talking about people who are being disordered, who are refusing to submit to authority, to do what they're told, to be reasonable and calm. And so it's often the noise or the violence of their actions that are kind of commented on. And they use very simple words. They say basically, he's mad. He's mad and he should be sent to Sydney and we should do something with him in Sydney. Or he's creating a disturbance, that sort of language.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with historian James Dunk about the history of early mental illness, or as they referred to at the time, going mad in the early days of the colony of New South Wales. Madness and the sea tended to go hand in hand. There's quite a few stories of ship's captains and others who had to be diagnosed as mad, as they put it, and relieved of their commands for the sake of everyone on their ship. Well, yes, because, I mean, after all, being captain of a ship is a highly responsible position, isn't it?
Mm.
Tell us some of those stories.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great story in a sense. It's not a nice story. Not many of the stories are nice, of course. John Grant is a convict that I start the book with. He's a kind of a young man. He's, in a sense, a romantic character, although other people, I think, might see him as a bit more of a stalker or an obsessive lover who turns violent. But he's a poet, and he has this sense of his own righteousness, his own justice, and he's very likable. A lot of people take to him. On the ship out, which he kind of sees as an emigration rather than as a sentence of convict transportation or exile, he tries to make it out as a positive move for him. Anyway, on the ship out, he befriends the officers, including the young captain, who takes him into his kind of life and shares his cabin and kind of makes this overtures of friendship. But during the voyage, he drank more and more heavily. And as John Grant says, he kind of fell into a stupor and became mad, intoxicated, but more than that, mad, and drank himself to death outside Rio de Janeiro.
Really?
And I mean, that's, you know, that's an anecdote. They're all anecdotes is what we're working from here because we don't have those records. But there are other cases, of course. George Maxwell was a lieutenant in a ship that had gone from Sydney out to collect some food in what we call the Hungry Years at the beginning of a European presence in Australia. And he was, I think, a lot of pressure in this situation. The colony was suffering. It was hard. They were making this fairly desperate trip out to the Cape Colony, South Africa. And we know really is that at one point he had the night watch and he is in this kind of vicious sea with icebergs everywhere and this kind of winds picking up. And instead of calming everything down, taking down the sail, he set more and more sail and the ship was leaning down in towards the sea. And the captain was actually thrown from his bed, who's John Hunter, some people might recognize the name. He's the governor of Sydney later on. But he's thrown from his bed, comes up on deck to see what's the problem. And he quickly sees that George Maxwell is mad and sends him below. And he's later on, you know, treated well and put in a hospital in Sydney in the rocks.
Okay.
But again, he very quickly identifies. He's just obviously mad, doing an irrational thing, which is dangerous.
Yes. John MacArthur, of course, famous in Australian history for his work on merino sheep and his role in the so-called Rum Rebellion, which overthrew the Governor William Bligh in 1803. He had mild to severe mental illness for most of the latter half of his life, didn't he?
Well, I mean, maybe even almost his entire adult life. Yeah. It's hard to say, and this is something we can get at through his letters and diaries rather than something that's kind of diagnosed at the beginning. But it seems that he had a form of depression or bipolar, you know, we want to be careful with his words, but an anxiety that everyone around him knew perfectly well. And it's almost that towards the end of his life, when he's formally diagnosed as insane by the court, you know, his wife says, "We always knew that the mighty mind would break. We always saw this coming. He had this suffering, this mental malady, they called it, or depression at different times. And we can see it running through the course of his life. And partly I try and in the book try and say his actions around the rebellion were this, you know, really ambitious undertaking. He's really setting himself and his friends up against the might of the empire. He thought he would get away with it, really. He thought that he would be able to convince them that it was the right thing to do to depose the governor. But it turned out that that was not how the empire saw it. And John MacArthur actually had to stay in England for 8 years, not sure what would happen when he returned. You know, he's chafing. He really wanted to get back. He saw his business interests collapsing. His wife was suffering in some ways at home in New South Wales. But he had to stay there because he didn't know if he'd be executed when he got back.
There was also an interesting part of this whole story too, is what officials did with the property of those deemed mad. There's the story of Jonathan Burke McHugo, for example. Tell us his story, because officials had to be careful here. Just because a person was mad didn't mean that they could just sell your stuff.
No, it's a great story. He's a very likable character. He's a royal pretender. He saw himself as the heir to the throne, and therefore very hard done by because he kept running into trouble. But somehow he managed to convince some investors that he should take this ship full of cargo from Calcutta to New South Wales and, you know, trade, be a merchant. When he arrived, instead of, you know, selling his cargo and making a profit, he went down to what was Van Diemen's Land, the river down there. And he started flogging his merchandise, sure, but in a very wild way, and convinced the authorities that he was a kind of a commissioner sent to investigate the conditions in the colonies. By some account, it's very hard to say exactly, but by some accounts, he almost had the governor, the commandant down there, he was almost going to execute him, and the other officers as well. Some junior officers managed to wrest control and have Jonathan Burke McHugo sent back to Sydney, where he was placed in this asylum that we talked about before at Castle Hill. He was sent along with some of his assets, which had been liquidized, to Calcutta, where he was again put in an asylum, which is not much of an asylum. But then a few years later, he turns up in London at the Colonial Office saying, "Where's my money? What's going on?" And then the Colonial Office, I mean, the interesting thing, it takes him seriously. And it writes to Lachlan Macquarie in Sydney saying, "What's happened?" But as you say, Lachlan Macquarie is careful. He and the judge, Ellis Bent, had taken careful procedures, had done it all legally above the board, had sold all the goods which were remaining, and had kept receipts. And so was able to send them back to London and say, we're fine here. We did the right thing.
Here's the money.
Here's the money.
Yeah, interesting. It wasn't all as as chaotic as you might have imagined. It's a very interesting book. It's called Bedlam at Botany Bay, and I've been talking to the author, James Dunk. James, great to talk. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.